There are many words of four letters that people would prefer not to hear. At the moment, you can include Zika on that list. For a very short word, a name actually, it inspires a wealth of concern, and with good reason. The pictures of children with abnormally small heads, microcephaly is the condition, caused by Zika in utero, communicate the seriousness of the issue. Donald G. McNeil Jr. goes into great depth in his book, Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. Donald McNeil works for the New York Times, where he started as a copy boy 40 years ago. He's a former Africa correspondent and counts 55 countries among the places where he's filed reports. Donald's current beat is science reporting, specifically plagues and pestilence. Donald McNeil, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So one of the first revelations is that Zika is not newly discovered. How long have we known about the virus?
It was discovered in 1947 in a monkey in the Zika forest in Uganda. Not much attention was paid to it. It probably went to Asia sometime in the 1960s. It seems to have left there and started sort of island hopping across the South Pacific in 2007 or so. There was an outbreak on Yap Island in Micronesia, which is one of the places that the Marines and the Japanese fought over in World War II, or actually the Navy and bombers did. And then it was in French Polynesia, and it was only really noticed and really began terrifying people when it turned up in Brazil. And at the end of last year, Brazilian officials announced that they had an epidemic of microcephaly among babies in several cities in the Northeast, and they were trying to figure out what it was and whether or not Zika was the cause.
So given that it had appeared before and certainly has been around for several decades now, I mean, was it well known or understood before we started seeing the microcephalic babies in Brazil?
No, I mean, it was known, it was discovered, but there's lots and lots of viruses that, you know, most people have never heard of. There's Anyang virus and simian foamy virus and Spondwini virus and Bunyamera virus and St. Louis encephalitis and a lot of other things. And we don't think about them because they're under the radar or rarely cause disease or cause disease in places that are far away. And Zika was just one of the many diseases. There was a paper written in 2009 saying that the Americas were threatened by Zika, and that so the paper was very prescient, but the scientist who wrote it actually said it was sort of down among the also-rans. He thought Rift Valley fever or Japanese encephalitis were going to be the big threats here, and, you know, so far so good on those, but Zika turned up and is causing problems.
So when the microcephalic babies began being born in Brazil, I mean, did anyone notice a trend? I guess what I'm asking is how long it took people to begin turning toward a specific virus as a cause.
Well, you know, Brazil is a country that has, you know, a lot of poor people, but it also has a lot of first-rate hospitals. And in some of those cities in the Northeast, which is, you know, on the equator, so you have mosquito transmission of diseases all year round because you really don't have winter and summer. You just have wet season and dry season. Doctors who worked in the neonatal intensive care wards began to talking to each other because they said, you know, I've got five babies with microcephaly in my ward right now, and I usually see one every 2 years, and other doctors say, God, I've got three in mine. And it became sort of a buzz among neonatal intensive care specialists, and they began doing their own investigation, talked to the women, to the mothers, and many of them said, well, you know, I had that disease that was going around. It was called the doença misteriosa, you know, the mystery disease in Brazil, and it was this mild rash, low fever, red eyes, conjunctivitis and stuff, and they'd had it roughly 9 months before, but nobody thought that much of it because it didn't hospitalize anyone. It wasn't a severe illness. But when they began to realize, wow, so many of these women had this disease, maybe that's the cause, and they began looking into it. And it was months before they really ascertained that it was the cause, but it was one of the chief suspects early on because everybody had noticed this weird, not terribly serious, but very widespread disease months before.
So this doença misteriosa, was it the kind of thing that might keep them away from work for, I don't know, 2 or 3 days or something?
Yeah, it's that kind of a level of disease. I mean, a fever of, you know, 102 or so at most, and then bright red eyes and a rash that sort of made people nervous. People thought it was dengue or thought it was chikungunya. There were other diseases they were more worried about in that part of Brazil. And when it turned out to be Zika, even the national health minister said, well, now that we know what it is, we're not that worried. We know that Zika is a mild disease. And then it had this sudden, terrible side effect in it. And for most people, it is mild, but for babies, it can be fatal.
All right. So we've all seen the pictures, and they are rather shocking to look at a microcephalic baby. Can babies born with microcephaly develop normally long run, or do we even know at this point?
Well, not with the kind of microcephaly you're seeing in the pictures. Mm-hmm. I mean, microcephaly is a broad catch-all term, so that even the child with a smallish head, you know, can be called microcephalic but have a perfectly normal life. But when babies have the tiny, tiny heads and inside them the shrunken brains that you're seeing, no, a lot of those babies, I mean, many of them, some of them die in the womb. Some of them die in the first days after birth. Some of them just have one seizure after another. Many of them have other defects that their tongues get in the way of their being able to swallow or breathe. Many of them are going to have severe mental retardation. They're going to have severe abilities learning to walk or to run. Some will never be able to control their bowels. I mean, there's a whole spectrum. And some will have fairly normal childhoods, but one of the suspicions is that they might have learning disabilities, and then later in life they might develop schizophrenia. And so if there's some evidence that, you know, an insult to a fetus while it's in the womb can have, even a smallish one, can have bad effects later in life. You don't see anything obvious on brain scans, but then they have problems 15 years from now, which is when schizophrenia develops.
So a key thing to understand here is did Zika mutate or otherwise turn more virulent in recent years, or was it just that nobody had tracked microcephaly in quite these numbers back to Zika in the mother while pregnant?
The virus has mutated some, but there's no, I mean, all viruses mutate all the time, so that's how you tell different strains apart, but it isn't mutating anything that anybody can point to and say, wow, that's the killer change. We don't know enough about Zika to be able to, you know, we haven't studied it long enough or done the genomes long enough to really know, but probably no. Probably it's always had this power, but it was never concentrated in a population quite like this, where you had, you know, Brazil, 3 million babies are born every year in Brazil. I mean, you've got all these babies, you know, all these mothers who've, none of whom have had the virus before, and you have a virus that maybe once in 1,000 cases causes a case of microcephaly. You know, when you can have a lot of bad effects from that, and that's may have been what happened. And when it was going around Asia in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, the number of cases of microcephaly might have been disguised by the fact that there were, you know, there was rubella was going around, toxoplasmosis was going around, other diseases were. Mothers might have had fetal alcohol syndrome or industrial poisons, mm-hmm. and a lot of people gave birth at home.
All right, more kinds of stuff to talk about here, obviously, with Donald McNeil Jr. His book is Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. Back on the exchange with him and you in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Donald G. McNeil Jr., science reporter for the New York Times. His beat is specifically plagues and pestilence. And so he's written a book called Zika, The Emerging Epidemic, to help us understand the virus, what we know about it scientifically, and what we're learning often the hard way as the things develop in people, like cases of microcephaly in Brazil and other places. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore the contents of the book and the implications of the virus. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Donald, I have to ask how daunting it was to try to put this book together, given how quickly we've had to learn about it and how much we're still learning day by day.
Probably embarrassing to admit, but I wrote it in 30 days, or actually 30 nights and weekends while I was doing my day job. I got called by an editor at Norton and said, can you write me a book, 30,000 words in 30 days? And he said, you know, if you don't make the deadline, you don't get a penny. If you do make the deadline, you know, we'll be real happy and we'll get it on the newsstands by June in time for, you know, the worry. And the worry is ramping up. Here on the East Coast, it's 90 degrees. I was listening with a lot of envy to your weather report.
Yes.
I'm from San Francisco, so I'm used to kind of cool weather in
sure.
the summers, but here it's 90 degrees and it's 75 at night. So there's a lot of worry about mosquitoes, although they haven't, you know, they're not in New York now. But you know, the worry in Florida and the Gulf Coast and parts of Hawaii is real.
And just now I was looking at the news items about Zika today, and I got a couple of California counties, Riverside and Fresno, reporting their first cases. So it's definitely creeping northward as time goes on.
Those are travel cases, right?
I didn't get a chance to look at those. I believe so. Let's go back in time, though, because you mentioned first discovered in the Zika forest in Uganda in 1947. Was there anything outstanding about it then? Anything that indicated it was going to become what it has become?
Nothing. No, it was discovered there in a monkey. They in those days they hoisted monkeys up into towers that were built up at treetop level. The monkeys would be taken down into cages every day, and their temperatures would be taken. And then when one monkey developed a fever, they took it to the lab and drew blood. So nobody knew if it was a human disease at the time. Later, they found it in a 10-year-old girl in Nigeria, and that was the first human case. That was a few years later in the 1950s. And they did some blood tests that showed that, you know, once they had developed an antibody test, they did a test that showed that a good percentage of the people in one village had antibodies, which suggested that it sort of circulated silently in Africa. You know, I mean, people had lots of diseases. They had malaria parasites. They had, you know, plenty of other viruses. So if it's a mild disease, it would have gone under the radar. No one would have noticed it. And so, but girls probably would have gotten it before they were old enough to have babies. So the big and bad effect never hit them.
So I want to come to the actual testing part of this, because this is not the kind of testing that is allowed anymore, I understand, the kinds of things they did with the monkeys.
Well, you know, we still have sentinel animals around sometimes. We don't hoist monkeys up into trees to let them get bitten to look for diseases. But we do, you know, the veterinarians and doctors do draw blood from captive animals in zoos and other animals that are likely to get bitten by whatever is around, and they draw the blood and they test it for diseases. There are such things as sentinel chickens and stuff that are kept out looking for avian flu in areas. There's regular veterinary testing of a lot of herds now, so you pick up viruses that way rather than having to, you know, jail monkeys in cages and hang them up in trees.
Okay, good to know. By the way, I did go back and check. The Fresno and Riverside cases are both people who had traveled outside the country to the Caribbean. So yes, they are travel cases.
Okay.
Some of the things that the researchers did in the early days of Zika, I guess they do this with a lot of viruses too, so it's not just a Zika thing, but the idea of researchers, some of them injected themselves with the virus?
Yep. There's a long history of doctors injecting themselves with drugs or with treatments or trying new things on themselves. Somebody who did some of the early research on burning materials for the U.S. Army used their own arms as a test for, first-degree and second-degree burns, but then did the third-degree burns on tests on pigs. It's not uncommon for doctors to try things out that they think are relatively safe on themselves as an experiment. It's considered, you know, kind of inside the profession, it's considered, putting yourself in harm's way before you put anybody else in harm's way is considered an honorable thing to do, even though ethics boards sort of discourage it.
Wow. Donald McNeil is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Zika, the Emerging Epidemic. There's some great description in here about how viruses and cells interact. I mean, what is it that makes them hook up so easily?
Well, every cell in your body has receptors on the outside that it needs in order to get basically nourishment and a lot of other things into it. And sometimes viruses exploit those receptors by learning to match them. And so the cell, you know, attaches, you know, if it's a flu virus or anything else, the virus attaches to the cell and the cell sort of kind of engulfs it and pulls it inside. And now the virus is inside the cell and it hijacks the cell's machinery and starts making copies of itself. That's basically what viruses do. They're not really living organisms. They're just kind of little robots that grab the cell production machinery inside the cell and hijack it to make copies of more viruses, and then the cell explodes and releases those, and they go on to attack the nearby cells. That's disease.
Yeah, it's a great description. The idea of the cell blowing open is kind of gross when you get down to it, but that's the replication.
What's happening? Yeah.
So, you know, as you mentioned already, there's a bit of a crowd around Zika because lots of other viruses, and you went through dengue and chikungunya and all sorts of other things. I mean, so how prevalent are mosquito-borne viruses, particularly in the tropics? I mean, could it be any one of like a dozen things if you show up with certain symptoms at the doctor's office?
It could have been any one of a few, anyway. There are four different strains of dengue virus. Chikungunya has recently landed in this hemisphere. I think it started in 2013, around there. So a lot of these are circulating at the same time. Yellow fever exists, and of course, if you have, it's mostly in the woods. It's the city's outbreaks that are dangerous, but a lot of people had shots against yellow fever, and so that means you have antibodies in your blood. So if you had a disease and recovered from it, or if you've had shots against a disease and gotten those, you have antibodies in your blood. So it becomes hard to test for some things because the antibodies cross match and create false positives for each other. So if you've had if you've had Zika, you're probably going to come up positive on a test for dengue or yellow fever. And so that's a problem in Latin America. It's not so much of a problem in the United States because most people haven't had dengue or yellow fever shots. So now if somebody had a, you know, if somebody in Texas or California had a Zika test, a positive Zika test would probably mean Zika.
All right, you quote someone from the CDC saying that the more we learn about Zika, the scarier it gets. I mean, if this is a researcher saying it, what is it that's scaring them?
Well, nobody's ever seen a disease, a mosquito-borne disease that attacked fetuses before. There's lots of similar diseases, but they don't go through the placenta and attack the fetus. Nobody's ever seen a mosquito-borne disease that's also sexually transmitted. Nobody knows how long it lasts in men. The longest anybody has ever caught it is 2 months inside a man's semen, but they don't know how long it exists theoretically. So there's a lot of mysteries about it, and it's quite scary because you have to change your prevention messages. I mean, it's one thing to tell people to avoid mosquito bites, and it's a whole other thing to tell them to try to wear condoms while having sex with their wives while they're trying to have a baby. It's a different message, and it's a tough message to convince people to listen to.
So let's get a sense of how radical that message was in Brazil when they started recommending. I mean, this is nothing that Brazil's health authorities, I think, have ever said before, you know, to avoid unprotected sex.
Well, no, they said avoid unprotected sex because they have an HIV problem in Brazil. But what they're saying now is the startling thing was, and it made me realize that they started saying, please avoid having babies. You know, just avoid getting pregnant right now. What one high up health official in Brazil said that early on, and that was one of the first things that made me sit up last December and go, oh my God, I've never heard that before. I mean, other than the China's one child policy, I mean, governments don't normally tell their women not to have babies because, you know, carry out that policy long enough and your country ceases to exist. So that's pretty radical talk, and yet it was the advice given out by one minister in Brazil and then El Salvador, Colombia, Ecuador, Jamaica, a couple of other countries gave out similar advice because they were overwhelmed. They knew mosquito control wasn't working, and they weren't sure how they could protect their women from having babies with birth defects.
Donald G. McNeil, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Donald G. McNeil Jr., I should point out, his book is Zika, the Emerging Epidemic. We're learning a lot about Zika virus today and all the horrible things it can do. You can join the discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I understand Zika in particular. Is there any other virus that goes for nerve tissue quite the way that Zika does?
Well, polio attacks the nervous system. I mean, it's a very different virus, but it attacks the nerves. If I think about it, I can think of others, sure.
But that does make it somewhat unusual, it sounds like, though.
Yes, and attacking the growing brain. Cytomegalovirus will attack the growing brain. Toxoplasmosis, which is a parasite, attacks the fetal brain. I mean, it's not uncommon, and it's all right. But no mosquito-borne virus has been known to do this before.
Okay. Now, the placenta is normally an effective barrier, as you pointed out in the book. Even if a mother gets it, it often will not. I mean, not anything but Zika. It sounds like will usually get stopped by the placenta.
The placenta is a semi-permeable barrier. It's meant to protect the baby, but at the same time, it's got to feed the baby. So some stuff has to get through. And just like viruses learn how to exploit the receptors on the outside of your cells, some viruses learn to exploit the membranes of the placenta to get through into the baby. So, syphilis can get through to a baby and cause horrible damage in utero. Herpes can get through sometimes to babies and cause horrible damage. Cytomegalovirus definitely can. Industrial poisons can. There are a lot of things that can harm a fetus. That's why, you know, we're very reluctant to try out vaccines on pregnant women because a fetus is an incredibly, incredibly vulnerable stage of human life. And many viruses don't, but some do. And the ones that do are the dangerous ones to the baby.
There's an interesting story in the book about the EIS team working at the island of Yap that you mentioned already in Micronesia. Tell us about what happened at Yap and who the EIS team is.
EIS is the Epidemic Intelligence Service of the CDC. It's sort of their elite division. Its symbol is a globe with a footprint attached to it, but it's basically the bottom of a shoe, and there's a hole worn in the bottom of a shoe, like a detective who's worn a hole in the bottom of a shoe working on a case. And they're the ones who investigate outbreaks, and it might be, you know, listeria in, you know, in scallions in the Middle West, or it might be an outbreak of a viral disease in on Yap Island in Micronesia. And in this case, they send a team out there because a doctor in Micronesia says, you know, I've got something here, and it's not coming up positive on dengue cases, but it sure looks like dengue, and we don't know what it is. And since Micronesia was captured from the Japanese at the end of World War II, it's one of the places that the United States, it's not a territory like Puerto Rico or Guam, but it's got a compact of free association with the United States. So we provide some services, including the CDC comes and investigates disease outbreaks. And they got there basically as the disease had just peaked, but they did a lot of surveys of households and saw, you know, and figured out that it was mosquito, and they sent samples back to Colorado where the big laboratory is, and they figured out it was Zika, which surprised the heck out of everybody because nobody heard of Zika outside of Africa and far away in Asia before, so that they knew the disease was on the move. But nothing serious happened. There was no microcephaly. There was no Guillain-Barré. It was seen as a mild disease that everyone recovered from. So there was kind of a sigh of relief, but it was a mistaken sigh of relief.
So Yap is such a remote place. I know we interviewed an author who spent some time there a couple of years ago, and he mentioned the fact that it took two or three flights to get there from a place of any size. So any idea how it got carried to Yap, Zika, from where else?
Well, you know, Yap and a lot of islands around there are connected to Australia, to Indonesia. You know, there's a fair amount of inter-island traffic, so it might have been on some other islands, and nobody noticed it because it's a relatively mild disease. But no, I mean, they know that the strain on Yap is closely related to the strain that was circulating in Cambodia in 2010, but Yap was 2007. It probably didn't come from Cambodia. It just happens to be, there's been so little sampling for this disease that there aren't very many, you know, good, there's no tracking of it around the world. So, you know, maybe someplace it went from Cambodia, someplace in Indonesia, and maybe from there it got the Yap. Nobody's quite sure.
All right, so you did mention Guillain-Barré. Is this the reason that people started showing up at emergency rooms in French Polynesia in November, I guess, of 2013?
That's right. Yeah, French Polynesia recognized they had a Zika outbreak, and because they had quite a good surveillance system, and they have 86 inhabited islands, and they have lots of clinics that call into the capital on Tahiti and say, "Hey, we've got this or that going on this week." They knew they had an explosion of a mosquito, probably mosquito-borne disease. But it seemed mild, and so they recorded it, but they didn't make a big deal out of it. And then all of a sudden, people started coming into emergency rooms basically paralyzed. And Guillain-Barré syndrome is a form of sort of creeping paralysis that starts in your hands and feet and creeps towards you, and it can take place over days, or it can take place in minutes. It's very unpredictable. Basically, if it reaches your chest and is about to paralyze your breathing muscles, you have to be put on a respirator pretty quickly, or you'll die. But for many people, it doesn't get that far, but it's terrifying. People have described it as being like, you know, sinking in a sea of mud or slowly turning to stone. For most people, it goes away by itself, but it can take months. And for some people, they have lifelong either pain or weakness in some muscles. It's like getting a mild form of polio. Well, it's not always mild. It's like getting a form of polio that goes away. And Guillain-Barré always is around. I mean, you and I have a chance, about a 1 in 100,000 chance of getting it this year if we have a bad cold or a stomach virus, or we eat raw chicken or some other things that could cause it. But this is an elevated risk. It's 1 in 5,000 instead of 1 in 100,000.
So that much more frequent with Zika than with all the other viruses that can cause it?
Some other viruses are thought to cause it too. Chikungunya, which is also circulating, may be one of the causes. It's still kind of mysterious because it's hard to test for, because it strikes after you've recovered from the disease, usually within a few weeks. But so you're not in the middle of the disease. In fact, you think you're out of the woods, and then suddenly, whammo, you get hit by this, you know, paralysis.
So, very, very scary thing. You know, and I've known people who had Guillain-Barré, and they do come back. I mean, they get their bodies back, but it takes a while in some cases.
Yeah. And they were terrified while they had it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Because they didn't know when it was going to stop or if it would stop. It's hard to tell when, you know, okay, it's peaked and now it's going away. You never know when that moment comes, and it's terrifying.
So did Brazil, in addition to the microcephaly cases, notice any increase in Guillain-Barré syndrome as well?
They did. It wasn't really, that didn't make the news until later, but some doctors had definitely noticed that there was Guillain-Barré cases. But since other things were circulating, dengue and chikungunya and stuff were circulating there anyway, they didn't really say, aha, Zika, Guillain-Barré. Only a few experts knew about it. It was not sort of widely a source of terror and making a lot of headlines there. It was the microcephalic babies which started turning up in August, last August there, that created the first real terror, and then a lot more investigators started looking at what had happened since Zika had arrived.
What's the rate of microcephaly now in Brazil? Is it staying about the same, or has it dropped off? I mean, obviously we've known about this long enough that people don't want to get pregnant.
Yeah, the numbers are still kind of. One question is, if a woman has Zika during her pregnancy, what are the chances that her child will have microcephaly? And we don't have a hard number for that. Might be 1 in 13, might be 1 in 3. So it's tough to know. Total population, there's 3 million babies born a year in Brazil, and right now about 2,000 of them are confirmed with microcephaly. So it's a small thing, but it's a terrifying thing.
It is indeed. We're talking more with Donald G. McNeil, Jr. about his book, Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. When we come back to the Jefferson Exchange, you're welcome to join the conversation as well. You may have many questions. We would like to hear from you. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Exchange to talk more about Zika in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the New York Times science reporter Donald G. McNeil, Jr. He's written a book called Zika, The Emerging Epidemic, which really puts together a lot of what we know now about Zika and how it can be dealt with in the world. And there are a lot of things we still don't know. That is clear as well. You can join our discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. We know that it's mosquito-borne. We talked about sexual transmission. Can Zika be passed casually person to person, body fluids, any other sorts of things?
No, sexually, but not casually. I mean, it's been found in saliva, but there's no suggestion to spread by kissing or anything. HIV is, spread sexually, but not through kissing. So the viruses are different that way.
There's a whole chapter in the book called My First Brush. Your first knowledge of Zika points out that your job is almost like triage in a sense. Tell us about the things you do as you're seeing pest and pestilence come across your desk. Plagues and pestilence, I should say.
I get between 300 and 500 emails a day from people wanting me to write about various studies of diseases, and I scan websites and read about things like, Congo Crimean hemorrhagic fever and Lassa fever and bat viruses and banana wilt diseases and things like that, and it's hard figuring out, okay, which one rises to the level of something that is a serious threat to the United States or to New York Times readers or to or to so many people in the world that we need to write about it right now, or what. It's kind of a constant triaging process, and yeah, there is a certain amount of media panic over various diseases, and the things swing kind of wildly, but my job isn't to spread panic. My job is sometimes to spread caution and hope, common sense about diseases. So I heard about this because it was actually a slow week after Christmas. I had heard about Zika once before, several months before, in a conversation with a scientist, and I had just sort of put my notes aside in my head scratcher pile and said, maybe I'll write about this someday. And then I saw an article out of Brazil saying that, a member of the health ministry had suggested that women not have babies because this disease was causing such horrible birth defects. And that made me sit up and say, oh, my God, I've got to write about this. And that's, basically I had a story in the paper that afternoon.
As you look at the response of health officials in Brazil, at the world level, at the CDC, what's your overall perception of the speed of action there?
There have been moments when I've been extremely frustrated because I thought the CDC was dragging its feet about issuing a travel warning especially to pregnant women, especially since it was January and it was the height of the, you know, travel to the Caribbean season. On the other hand, they haven't been unresponsive, and the advice, you know, it clears to me, you know, it seems to be always based on science and sensible advice. You know, their, you know, bureaucracies don't move as fast as they might. The WHO is much more cautious than the CDC is, because WHO just never wants to point a finger at any member country and say, hey, you know, this country has a, you know, has a disease and nobody should go. But they came around to saying, hey, look, pregnant women should not go to this list of countries, you know, while this disease is being transmitted there. And that's a, you know, for the WHO, that's an act of courage, to point to some countries and say, hey, it's too dangerous to go there, because they're, you know, it's a big members club and the members get really upset when you point at that. You know, questions come up like, you know, the CDC, when it issued its travel warning, said that you should avoid entire countries. And that would upset, you know, if the virus was in one small part of Mexico and everybody was in Mexico City up, you know, a mile in the air, was perfectly safe. You could see the Mexican government getting upset the same way if the virus was in Florida and the European CDC said, well, don't go to the United States, don't even go to Maine or Minnesota because they've got Zika in Florida. And, you know, that's America. You can see that some of these things are politically sensitive, but they, you know, mostly I think they've been responsive, if I had to put it in one phrase.
How widespread was it even in Brazil? I mean, you mentioned in the book it started in Recife and some of the northeastern coastal towns. Did it move even farther south into the country, or was it pretty limited?
No, it's moved quite a bit. But it moved, the first big explosion appeared to have been in the northeast, and the northeast is on the equator, so you've got year-round, you know, you don't have winter and summer. You have wet season and dry season. Then you have year-round mosquito transmission, so you can get up quite a whirlwind, can be built up in the favelas, the slums outside the big cities, a virus being transmitted very quickly from mosquito to person to mosquito to person. It began moving out from there. You know, viruses move with mosquitoes, but they also move with people. So, you know, you found virus in the Cape Verde Islands, you know, which are a long way and near the coast of Africa, but that was probably because they're Portuguese-speaking. It's probably people from Brazil going to Cape Verde back and forth. It's moved all the way into the interior of Brazil now. It's moved down south to Rio. But in Rio, it waxes and wanes because Rio, like Florida, has, you know, winter and summer. So you have high season and low season for mosquito transmission. And it moved east along the equator, or west along the equator, to Colombia and Ecuador and Venezuela pretty quickly, and then it began moving north up the up Central America.
We have a caller here on the line. Welcome to John and Grants Pass. We're talking to Donald G. McNeil, the author of Zika, the Emerging Epidemic.
Hi, thank you. The State Department has an interesting site. It has travel advisories and travel warnings for every country in the world. And I don't know if our listeners are aware of that, but if you are happening to travel, it's really good to know. I wanted to know if this Zika thing is probably included on there, and if you've seen that before. And then you may have covered this already, but, you know, some of the athletes, it looks like not very many so far, are not going to Rio. How serious is this real thing realistically for the Olympics? Thanks.
All right, thanks, John.
Okay. I don't look at the State Department websites as much as I look at the CDC websites, and they definitely, and I think the State Department website comes from there, they definitely have been warning about specific countries ever since January. On the Olympic athletes, there will be a chance of Zika transmission in Rio. It's winter in Rio in August, so but winter in Rio in August means more like 70 degrees, not 0 degrees. So there is still some mosquito transmission. The transmission of other diseases in Rio is about 5% in August, what it is in January and February. So the risk is lower. And, you know, I mean, not that many of us get bitten by mosquitoes when we're inside baseball stadiums or inside, at our kids' swim meets or things like that. So for the Olympics themselves, definitely there's a risk to pregnant women. There's no question about that. And for athletes and spectators who are, you know, trying to make a baby when they get back home, there's a real risk. And that's something that people need to pay attention to. But the average risk for most people is probably not very high because the disease itself is mild. You know, why golfers decide not to go, I'm not a golfer, I don't want to speculate, but I know that golfers make lots of money on the professional circuit and appearing on, you know, CBS News in the afternoon, or CBS, you know, TV in the afternoon. So I'm assuming that there are other incentives for them not to go to Rio and play golf for free when they'd have to give up earning a lot of money on the pro-am circuit.
Oh, interesting point. I hadn't thought about that part of it before.
Just cynical on my part, I guess.
Your term, not mine. The one of the issues, though, with Zika, too, is as we read further into the book, and it appears that there are some suspicions anyway, and it's probably too early in the lives of these babies, though, that there could be damage even without microcephaly. There could be some neurological damage.
That's the fear. I mean, it's known that in the aftermath of the rubella epidemic, the last big one in this country in 1964, that rates of learning disabilities and stuff in kids whose mothers had been affected during that epidemic were higher, and there was even some evidence that rates of schizophrenia, you know, 15 to 20 years later, when schizophrenia turns up, were higher. That was noticed among in a big Finnish study of people who'd been born during the big flu epidemic of 1957. There's some suspicion that schizophrenia, you know, there are powerful genetic factors in schizophrenia because it runs in families, and there are also trauma during your life whether trauma is abuse or drug use or a lot of other things seems to trigger it, but there may also be a component that has something to do with infection in utero, and there are a fair number of leading brain researchers who think this is possible. So they think if it can happen from other diseases that a mother gets in utero, Zika is one that's a candidate for that kind of damage.
All right, yeah, we talked about this being...
but we won't know for 15 years.
Okay, yeah, right. Sorry. It'll be a while. The transmission method, I mean, the way it moves around, mosquitoes, there are actually two kinds of mosquitoes that can carry Zika, is that right?
They're both Aedes mosquitoes. There's lots of families of mosquitoes. There's Anopheles, which carry malaria. There's Culex, which carries West Nile. There's Aedes. There's two Aedes mosquitoes. Aedes aegypti is the one that's famous for carrying it. I mean, the two Aedes mosquitoes here in the Western Hemisphere. Aedes aegypti is the one that is known to carry it. It's done 99.9% of all the transmission. Aedes albopictus, which is the Asian tiger mosquito that you heard about so much, you know, about 20 years ago when it first turned up in this country, it has been seen to carry it, to have it, but it's not known if it's a very efficient spreader because Aedes albopictus tends to go off and bite other things like birds and deer and dogs and stuff, and so it's not, whereas Aedes aegypti really likes to bite people and really likes to live inside houses and goes for people, you know, it breeds in your garden and then goes directly into your house. So that's the one that we worry about. And Aedes aegypti is a lot less widespread than Aedes albopictus. It's a constant presence in Florida and Texas around the Gulf Coast. And then the farther north you go, the more and more spread out it gets. I mean, they've been found as far north as New York City, but they're not normally around and not big clouds of them the way there are in Florida.
So what is going on in the way of mosquito control in the countries where Zika is already a great concern, and then what discussions are you finding in the United States about mosquito control to ward off Zika?
There's lots of efforts being made, and the efforts include lots of fogging trucks driving around blowing smoke in neighborhoods, but whether or not that's actually doing any good or whether it's just good for the TV cameras is unclear. These are mosquitoes that breed in your garden or in your shower drain, and so if a truck driving down the street spraying fog is only likely to make you close your windows, and you're closing the enemy inside the house with you. I've been asking since this began, you know, can you direct me to one city where it's very clear that mosquito control has actually so effectively cut the number of mosquitoes that it has cut the rate of disease transmission? And I never get you should go to here. I usually get a long pause and go, gee, I can't actually think of one.
Huh.
So, mosquito control is it's more of a PR exercise. I mean, unless people take responsibility and even when you clean up your own house and your own garden and stuff, you may have some neighbor who lives down the street who just says, you know what, I haven't put chlorine in my swimming pool for the last 2 years and I'm not going to, and I don't care how many mosquitoes fly out of my pool or out of my septic tank or wherever it is. So it's a very hard thing to do mosquito control. When it was done in Brazil in the 1930s, it was done basically by fascist tactics. People just, you know, army and police marched into people's houses, emptied out the water, sprayed the houses, with DDT, and whether people liked it or not, they just came through the gate. And, you know, we don't do that anymore.
No, and in fact, when I think about things like aerial spraying, I don't even know if that's on the table for mosquitoes. I think about the reaction to any aerial spraying, particularly like with the Medfly in Los Angeles 30 years ago.
And aerial spraying is not so good for Aedes mosquitoes because most aerial spraying is over parks and marshes and wetlands and things like that. We do that for West Nile virus because that's where those mosquitoes breed. But mm-hmm. Aedes mosquitoes will breed in your garden or in your house if they can, and you can't spray that way with a plane.
So is it? Can you even ward off the Aedes mosquitoes by dumping out the ponds of water, get rid of the bird bath, stuff like that?
I go out in my garden every couple of days, and I empty the water in the bird bath, and I put new water in it. And I check it looking, because I have a backyard in Brooklyn, and I keep looking for mosquito larvae. I think I empty it often enough so that none of them grow there. But I don't know what my neighbors are doing, and people could have a puddle on their roof that a mosquito can lay eggs in, and I'd never notice it. It's real hard to clean up all the standing water in any neighborhood. And the minute you do it, the minute it rains, you're back to square one.
Right, right. Well, it's one of the things we don't have to worry about too much in the summertime in the state of Jefferson, but still we get standing water. So let's talk about where things stand with efforts to slow the spread of Zika, to stop it from getting any worse. The news just today that the U.S. Army and Sanofi Pasteur are working on a vaccine. Is this a hopeful development?
There's like 20 different companies working on vaccines for Zika. And some of them are probably, the first couple are going to begin human testing August or September. But testing is going to take about 2 years minimum, even if it's going well, because with vaccines, it's one thing to put an experimental drug into somebody who's dying of cancer. It's a totally different thing to put a vaccine into a perfectly healthy person, and particularly a perfectly healthy pregnant woman with a baby inside her. You cannot make a mistake. So you have to do lots and lots and lots of safety testing and lots of testing to make sure the vaccine works before you roll it out. And Tony Fauci of the NIH has said, look, that's going to take us a minimum of 2 years.
Okay, so a bit of a road ahead of us still. Great tracking on where we stand right now in Donald G. McNeil Jr.'s book, Zika, the Emerging Epidemic. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right, take care.